Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Everybody talks about the weather, said Mark Twain, but nobody does anything about it. The same might be said about global warming and the United States. No big, bold push to take on climate change. Now there's one on the Senate floor. Critics say it would kill the U.S. economy. Backers say it won't, and we must have it anyway. It may not pass this year, but there's big stuff brewing here and a trillion-dollar question. This hour on Point, can our economy survive what it will really take to tackle climate change? In a moment, we'll talk not to a scientist, but to an economist who's been running the numbers through a supercomputer to figure out what it will cost our economy if this country does its part to stop global warming. But first, to catch up with the Senate this week and the Warner-Lieberman Climate Security Act, we turn to Andrew Revkin, an environment reporter for the New York Times. He joins us from New York. Andy Revkin, thanks very much for being here.
It's good to be with you.
We know you're skeptical, but let's people want to understand the terms of this debate, and let's listen to just a little bit. Here's Dianne Feinstein on Monday, the opening day of debate, on this bipartisan proposal, saying history is being made.
Today really marks a momentous step, because for the first time, we are considering comprehensive legislation to address global warming in a comprehensive manner. I believe the time has come for the Senate to pass legislation to tackle this problem.
And here, Andrew Revkin is Republican Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell saying Americans simply can't afford to pay what the Warner-Lieberman Act would cost.
At a time when Americans are struggling to pay their bills and when the price of gas seems to be rising higher and higher every day, the majority is showing itself to be laughably out of touch by moving to a bill that would raise the price of gas even higher.
Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. Andrew Revkin, New York Times, you've said that the chances of this passing this year, maybe ever, are nil, and yet Americans are being asked to catch up with this debate, and the stakes certainly seem to be enormous. What is on the table here, Andy?
Well, on the table is a mandatory broad, meaning across the economy, not just for power plants, that kind of thing, restriction that would build over time on greenhouse gases, which come mainly from burning fossil fuels. And that entails an eventual transformation of an energy system that's grown up for 200 years around coal and oil. And so it's a big transformation. The question of how much it will cost and the question of how much that cost would compare to the cost of not doing anything are kind of plastic, because every aspect of how this will play out in the future is somewhat uncertain, everything from human behavior to the climate itself. So you get all kinds of assertions about higher the assertion of higher gas prices comes from an economic analysis that, of course, the other side is already attacking as flawed. And there are analyses pointing to a green jobs revolution, but they don't tend to forecast how compare that to the loss of jobs in sort of fossil-based industries. So you can kind of pick your economic analysis. The bottom line is the science is crystal clear now that if we stay on a business-as-usual course, we're going to end up with centuries of climate change and retreating coastlines worldwide. But the solutions politically, in the political arena, it's such a bad fit. I, as a journalist covering climate for 20 years, I'm not convinced that the solution will come from the political process.
It may not at all, and yet that's what citizens and voters are asked to consider. We're going to hear a couple of different economic perspectives in this hour, but give us a sense of how what's being proposed here, you know, would work. Hypothetically, your colleague John Broder calls it, says it would entail the biggest changes to the U.S. economy since the New Deal era in the 1930s, and at the heart of it is this carbon emissions cap and trade proposal that's floated around for a long time. People still may not have focused on what it really means. How would it work?
Well, it's a mechanism that was first test-driven successfully with sort of the old-fashioned pollutants of the 20th century, like sulfur, where you have a cap, a global limit for American emissions. You ratchet that cap slowly down. Industries that emit the stuff either get a permit or those who could show that they've basically made deeper cuts than they would otherwise be required to do, get a credit, and they can kind of trade that to companies or institutions that have a harder time making quick cuts because they'd be costlier.
And we're talking industries like power plants and big factories, every place you see smokestacks billowing carbon emissions.
Yeah, and it was successful with sulfur in part because you have a discrete number of sources. You can kind of measure things pretty confidently, but in the long run, for it to play out effectively for carbon dioxide, which comes from everything, everything we do, the mobility, the connectivity, the, the running the servers for the internet, the wrong kind of farming, and the right kind of farming can pull it out of the air. And, you know, there's some impetus to get farm states on board by giving farmers credits for sucking in tons of carbon dioxide. But no one's figured out how to confidently measure that yet. So if a ton is going to be worth $40 or $50, and you're going to have a big commerce in it, one of the questions is how do you make that a good binding contract with firm values. So it's a tough transition for a gas like CO2 compared to some of the old pollutants. That's why some of the skeptics are, and this has nothing to do with the cost, or it's more about just the effectiveness of this approach.
We're talking about cutting greenhouse gas emissions in this country by 18%, which is quite a lot, by 2020, and by 2050 by more than two-thirds, maybe 70%. That's an enormous cut they're talking here, and you've got industry representatives saying that would croak us. That would put us at the economic competitive disadvantage. The cost of doing this would just throw a giant monkey wrench into the U.S. economy. Is there any consensus among economists on whether or not that's true?
Well, I'm sure you'll ask Bill Nordhaus that question. Mm-hmm. There's deep divisions, I think, among economists over how this can play out. I think history says that most energy forecasts have been grossly wrong. All the forecasts that for the expansion of renewables in the economy, things like solar and wind, for decades have been utterly wrong. Also, though, on the other side, improvements in efficiency, improvements in how we do things, the ability to kind of get CO2 out of the economy, in other words, to do things more efficiently, has been happening as well at paces that were hard to predict. And the oil price, just think about the unpredictability of oil prices. 2 or 3 years ago, there was no one, really very few people, forecasting $130 a barrel of oil, that kind of thing. So you can kind of pick and choose your economics. One thing that sort of amuses me, I'm trying to work on a story on this for the weekend, is comparing the economic modeling to the climate modeling. You know, there's a lot of conservatives and skeptics who've been pillorying climate scientists, but boy, oh boy, if you want to see a questionable model move into the economics arena.
Which we're going to do, and we're going to do right now. We know you're skeptical. You're saying you believe it may take a technological breakthrough, but of course nobody can count on that. In the meantime, we've got now Obama and McCain both favoring some kind of carbon cap and trade program. So this is likely, even if it doesn't pass now, to still be on the table, and maybe more vigorously so in the next 4 years.
Well, you know, stay tuned. I'd like to think there's another peril here, by the way, that a lot of climatologists worry about, which is if you're the atmosphere watching all this, you're not seeing much action. You're seeing emissions globally still rising, most of which are going to come in the next 30 years from China and India. And you're seeing a lot of rhetoric, and the atmosphere is sitting up there waiting, and these gases accumulate. They're not like the old sooty stuff that just, you know, put it out and you can kind of stop it. And there's this real concern that, suppose the Senate and suppose Congress passes a bill and a president signs one, a bill that's modest enough to make it through the gauntlet of things in Washington, and then that lets everyone go home and say they've done their job. Mm. But that's just the beginning. That could take all the political pressure off in a way, and that has a lot of climate experts concerned as well.
Andrew Refkin, environment reporter for The New York Times, author most recently of The North Pole Was Here, Puzzles and Perils at the Top of the World. Andy Refkin, thanks very much for being with us.
Sure.
With me now from New Haven, Connecticut, is William Nordhaus. He's a professor of economics at Yale University, widely considered one of the world's top authorities on the economics of tackling climate change. His latest book is A Question of Balance, Weighing the Options on Global Warming Policies. Professor Nordhaus, thank you very much for being with us today.
Great to be with you, Tom. It's a great show, so it's a great honor.
How do you begin to, I guess, let's just say it straight up, educate us on what it's going to take? I mean, is there a simple answer to the question, can we afford to genuinely tackle climate change?
The simple answer is yes. We can talk about some of the details. But if I could just step back one bit, I think one way to think of it is we're in a very long process now. The scientists, as Andy said, have established pretty clearly the idea of what the scientific issues are here. And they also have given us a rough idea of what we need to do. The next step is to put in place the political, economic, and social mechanisms that are going to basically decarbonize our economies. So it's as if the scientists have found a new strain of flu and we have to figure out what to do with it. I guess what I would emphasize is the idea of we need institutions to do this and we need mechanisms. And if you want to think of it, think of the Federal Reserve. We've had monetary problems for all of human history, but we now have an institution, a pretty well-run institution that manages our money, so we don't have to wake up every morning worrying about what our dollar is worth. So that's the kind of thing, the transformation we're going on. I think Andy had some very good points, and I agree with much of what he said. The only thing I would emphasize is this is going to take a while. It's going to take a while to educate the people around, not just in the United States, but around the world, and it's going to take a while to develop the mechanisms that are going to help us solve this problem.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the price of saving the planet. The Senate is debating caps on carbon emissions to rein in climate change, and we're asking what the U.S. can afford to do, what it can afford not to do, looking at the Senate's big climate, global warming bill, and what the U.S. economy can take. Big debate on the Senate floor this week. Here's Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota saying America has led the world out of dire straits before and that climate change is the next big challenge.
We have the opportunity to start moving and doing something about climate change. And when we set those standards, so many people around the world are waiting for us to act, to go first, as we have so many other times. Other countries have done things, but our country, the United States of America, making a statement on this will make a difference for the rest of the world. We need to set our expectations high. We need to set our standards high.
Set expectations high, but what will it cost? Here's Republican Kit Bond of Missouri saying this bill amounts to trillions of dollars in American pain, with zero gain in solving the international problem of global warming, that there's no point in leading if China and India won't follow.
Perhaps the most disturbing feature of this debate is that for all the pain on families and workers, for all of its $6.7 trillion price tag, it will have no measurable impact on world temperatures. That's right. The Environmental Protection Agency estimates that if China and India do not institute similar plans to the same extent we do, as they have already told us they will not, this bill before us will have no measurable impact on world temperatures.
Republican Kit Bond of Missouri on the Senate floor this week. With us from New Haven, Connecticut, Professor William Nordhaus. His new book is A Question of Balance, Weighing the Options on Global Warming Policies. And William Nordhaus, what about it? There's Kit Bond, Senator Bond, talking about all the pain that Americans would feel if this kind of step is taken. And he's talking about economic pain. How would you describe that? Is it a world of pain waiting for Americans? Is it a tolerable thing, or is it a net gain, as some of the green economy proponents would say?
Well, let's start out by saying what actually is going to happen. So the economics here contains one what I call fundamental inconvenient truth, which is that for any policy to be effective, it has to raise the market price of carbon. That's to say, it has to raise the price of those goods and services that have a lot of carbon used in producing them.
And when you say you're talking primarily about fossil fuels and the emissions they create out of our smokestacks, out of our tailpipes, and that has always been free, zero cost to that.
We're talking about the cost. Let's just take a specific example. If you are consuming electricity that's made from coal, then that's got a fair amount of carbon in it. So if, in fact, if you're going to do any of these bills, what you're going to do is you raise the price of carbon, that's going to raise the price of coal, and it's going to raise the price of electricity that's generated from coal. In the longer run, what you're going to do is then you're going to find people using other forms of generation, whether it's renewables or perhaps efficient natural gas or nuclear, and that's going to reduce the pain over the long run.
But the main thing, they don't produce that same CO2 emission in the same degree or at all.
But I think the main thing I would like to get across is the idea that I think many economists, most economists who've looked at this agree, which is the key thing we have to do is set up a market environment in which people face realistic prices when they consume carbon.
So if your energy produces carbon, you're going to have to pay for it. There'll be a ticker on it.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, and this is true. It's going to require new technologies and new behavior, but let's face it. We've got around the world thousands of governments, millions of firms, billions of consumers making trillions of decisions every year, and the only way you're actually going to get them to do the balancing, to make the decisions that are going to head us toward a low-carbon world, is to actually make them pay the price.
But it is a radical step. Just putting that price on carbon is a very big step, and I guess one piece of evidence of that is that it has to be a steep enough price to drive these enormous reductions in CO2 emissions that this bill and others are looking for. I'm reading here Stephen Hayward, American Enterprise Institute conservative. He puts out an index of leading environmental indicators every year. He's saying that what they're asking for would require the United States to take its emissions back to something like they were in 1910, when this country had 92 million people and a per capita income of $6,000, that per capita emissions would have to go down to around the level of Somalia and Haiti for us to meet these targets. Now, that does sound like a world of economic pain, as Kit Bond put it. Is that a reasonable way of looking at this?
I think it's not reasonable. I think what I would do if I wanted to understand this is I would look at what's happened in the European Union, because basically what we would be doing in these bills is adopting something very similar to what the EU already has in place. So you can actually look at that. You can look at what kinds of prices they're paying. You can look at the effects on their economy. And actually you can get a pretty good reading on what the economic impact is likely to be. And I think, well, you've got people on all sides of this. But I would guess that we would be talking about prices of carbon in the range of, say, $10 to $50 per ton of carbon dioxide. We've run many, many model runs on that. We can look at Europe to see what the reaction is. And I'll describe it in two words, in two says. Mm. First, people are going to see higher energy prices, and it's going to be maybe a third to a half of the kind of energy price increases we've seen since 2002. So if you want to calibrate in your mind how much pain there is to the U.S. consumer, just say, okay, how much pain have we had from the rising gasoline prices, say, since 2002? And it's maybe a half to a third of that. Okay, that just fix that in your mind, how much pain you felt as an economist. And these kinds of bills over the next 5 to 10 years will be roughly a third to a half of that.
We've seen the run-up in the last 5 or 10 years, all right, in gas and oil prices, and you're saying
yes,
a third to a half of that. What would that mean for standard of living, for economic growth?
So here the only thing I would emphasize is it's got to be done in a effective way. We can't have all these exemptions and the farmers are out and the truckers are out and the steel industry's out. It's got to be a universal and well-designed cap-and-trade system or the equivalent. And my guess is it would be at most a tenth of a percent a year over the next 10 years. I just think these Stone Age, Somalia, Haiti things are just completely wild and completely unsupported by economic evidence.
If you're talking then about that kind of margin of hit to growth, which sounds maybe manageable, will that produce the radical reductions in emissions that environmentalists are saying are necessary to stop global warming?
Well, I think it was Senator Bond, made a point which has to be emphasized. And this is something that Americans have to think about in this context, that this is not a national problem. This is a global problem. And to deal with this, we are going to have to get the world involved. It's like a nuclear proliferation problem, or it's like dealing with SARS. It's not something you can just sit here in the Senate and solve. If we do it alone, we're not going to solve the problem. But the United States, being the richest and biggest and most powerful country, has to take the lead and has to bring along other countries. But the basic idea is we do have to do this as a global cooperative effort. It's going to take a long time to do, but I think we can put a dent on it.
The EU has jumped in. The U.S. hasn't, of course, with Kyoto. China and India still out there on their own. But let's say if the Senate, if the Congress should pass, President Bush says he'll veto. But if he didn't, if something like what's on the table right now went through, I wish you'd continue to push down this road of what that would mean for the U.S. standard of living. Does it mean Americans could expect to be, you know, carbon cleaner by a radical degree and still have a standard of living something like today? Or are we talking about some different kind of standard of living? Can you describe that?
Yeah. Well, we have a – I think the short answer to that question is that you will take a small drop in the economic growth rate. And again, I can't see it being much more than a tenth of a percentage point per year. So if the per capita incomes are going up at a 1% a year over the next 30 years, then – maybe it would go down to 0.9%. The idea this is going to drive us down into declining living standards is just unsupported by any evidence.
Is that because the actual hit of reducing emissions is not that heavy, or because you imagine a green economy growing up in the place of those smoke-belching smokestacks and all the rest?
Okay, both. In the near term, what we're going to do is – you know, we can't change our capital stock very much. You know, it takes a while to build new electrical generating plants and build new efficient and buy new efficient automobiles. So in the short run, they're going to be relatively modest reductions. But I'd say over 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, as particularly, and I would emphasize this, if we're in a high carbon price environment, then what we're going to see is new technologies developed. And so we're going to have our standard of living plus, whatever it's going to be, with these new technologies, and I do think significantly reduced emissions of carbon.
Lots of economic wrinkles here and lots of questions, Professor Nordhaus, from our listeners. Let's go to Kenosha, Wisconsin, and Jeff. Jeff, you're on the air with Bill Nordhaus.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Great show. I have a very simple question. I do believe we're all on the right track, and our country does want to create legislation to control itself and from a carbon emission standpoint. But as we've seen a sort of a mass exodus of our economy to lesser economies to cut costs in other ways, standards for labor and other standards are not being met by countries we're trading with. And I'm wondering if our country, if you feel our country has the political courage to sit down at the table with our trade partners, primarily I think China and India, and say, as the most consuming nation in the world, buying so much from you, it's simply going to be a requirement that you meet environmental criteria that we do. It's sort of a reciprocation of what we're doing.
So all together now, does the U.S. have the leverage and the courage to do that? Jeff, thanks for your call. William Nordhaus, how about it? You have warned that there is potential for trade war in these times. The measure right now before the Senate would require the president to negotiate agreements with other countries, and if they didn't, tariffs could be imposed on carbon-intensive products, steel, paper, concrete, glass, and others. Do you see the U.S. having the leverage to sit down and get China, India, other developing countries to get on board with these kind of steps? And if they don't, do you see trade war?
Well, I think that's a really excellent question, and I think it's one that's been largely neglected, and that is that if you have some countries that are doing this and other countries that are not participating, how do they treat the imports and exports? Europe has already threatened to do trade barriers against the United States because we're not participating. You've seen what's in the Senate bill. There's a lot of division here among trade economists. I think a reasonable point of view would be to say that we'd go out and we would negotiate with other countries and we would say, if you participate in whatever the global accord is, there will be no trade interactions, restrictions. However, if you do not, you will find that there are duties on the products that have carbon imports into whatever countries participate. So this would mean that China and India. I don't know whether that's a big enough stip to bring them along, but it's basically one of the few carrots or sticks, whatever you want to call it, that could persuade countries that they should join in.
but all kinds of room for mischief here, you know, for straight-up tariffs that may not have climate change as their first concern as negotiations like that would go underway. It's a real thicket out there. Thanks for that call. Let's get a call from Cindy in Claremont, New Hampshire. Cindy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I believe that talking about all this change will take way too long. Americans are too spoiled and self-centered to monitor and control themselves, and I believe the American politicians and the leaders want to talk everything to death. So I believe it will take a magnitude crisis that requires overnight change for anything to happen in the United States and the world.
A crisis like what, though, Cindy? And would it come soon enough to...
I don't believe it will. I think a crisis like 9/11... I'm not that kind of outside terrorism or anything like that. I'm just saying it's something that scares everybody way to death and the consequences of that.
Mother Nature putting the hammer down somehow, maybe. Let's look at that in economic terms, and thank you for that, Cindy. William Nordhaus, we've got this big study out of Tufts University commissioned by the NRDC saying that over the next century, average temperatures in most of the U.S. could rise 13 degrees. Hurricane damage, real estate losses, increased energy and water costs of almost $1.9 trillion annually. Will that kind of economic cost begin speaking persuasively to the American polity, even if, you know, environmentalist warnings haven't yet?
Well, I think the main problem, I think Cindy raised a very good question, and I think the Tufts study doesn't address it. If you look at these studies, these impacts are pretty far down the road. They're not tomorrow or next year. They're decades in the future. So I think if we're going to wait around for an ecological disaster, we're just going to be waiting too long.
Mm.
So I actually think this is something where we have to be grown-ups. We have to say, okay, we've got a problem. We've got to sit down and we've got to think it through. Now, I would say we've made a lot of progress in the last 20 years. If you go back 20 years, this wasn't even on the agenda. And you go back 10 years and 7 years, and we had a president who said, "We're not even going to think about this." We've now got two likely candidates who are both committed to it. So I think we've come a long way. We do need to get some resolution. We need to get the United States out of the denialist mode and into a leadership role. And I trust that will happen over the next 2 or 3 years.
Americans like to think of themselves as practical people. As an economist, are you warning that if we don't take these steps, we'll pay an economic price for the environmental damage that might be on a par with what we may have to pay to fix it?
No, I don't. I think there will be damages. I think they're pretty far down the track. I think the way I think about it is our economy actually is pretty robust, but if we don't do something, we're basically going to wreck the world we live in. We're going to wreck the oceans. We're going to wreck a lot of the natural ecosystems. It's a kind of world and ecology destroying path we're down. But, you know, I just can't say that our economy is going to be wrecked by this because these studies don't show that. But a lot of the things outside of the GDP, so to speak, are really in danger.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the price, maybe, of saving the planet, about the Senate's big global warming bill, putting caps on carbon emissions in this country for the first time, if it would pass, and what the U.S. economy can take in terms of addressing global climate change, what it can afford to do, what it can afford not to do. William Nordhaus has been with us from New Haven, Connecticut, professor of economics at Yale, author of the new book, A Question of Balance, Weighing the Options on Global Warming Policies. Lots of debate in Washington this week. Here's Senator Barbara Boxer, Democrat of California, urging colleagues not to fear the price tag of fixing global warming, but with a hint of FDR here, to be afraid of the fear of fear itself.
I can only say to colleagues, don't be fearful, because you have nothing to be fearful about. I'll tell you what there is to be fearful about: doing nothing, saying no, turning your back on the scientists, on the religious leaders who are with us, on the mayors, the governors, on so many supporters who understand this. That will be dangerous because gas prices are shooting up to the sky, and if we don't get off of oil, that's our future. With this bill, that is not our future.
Nothing to fear, she says. Republican Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma, who in 2003 called the threat of catastrophic global warming the greatest hoax ever perpetuated on the American people, said this bill would not only be crippling, it wouldn't work, but it would create more carbon emissions.
It ignores the needs of American families. It jeopardizes the jobs of American workers. It does not offer a global solution, and in fact will increase global emissions. And it does not promote good, clean energy solutions, and in fact will make us even more dependent upon foreign sources of energy.
The sky is falling, says the Oklahoma senator, in this bill. William Nordhaus is with us from New Haven, Connecticut, with us from Washington right now. Joseph Rumm, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, editor of the blog climateprogress.org. Time magazine named it one of the top 15 green websites. He's author of Hell and High Water, Global Warming, the Solution, and the Politics. Joseph Rumm, thank you very much for being with us.
And my pleasure.
So what are you hearing in this week's debate in the Senate about whether or not this country can afford to do what's necessary to address climate change?
Well, I think, the debate is very informative. On the one side, I think our people who have a genuine understanding not just of the cost of inaction, which I think is enormous, but I think Senator Boxer's point on gasoline prices is very important. It's now pretty clear that we are facing a time when supply of low-cost conventional oil is peaked or near peak, and this is something that major oil executives have begun to say. So people have to understand we're going to see higher gasoline prices over the next several years and then much higher after that. So I think, we need to get off of oil. And the, United States has never adopted an energy policy that was aggressive enough to substantially get us off of oil. And, while I agree with Dr. Nordhaus that we need a price for carbon dioxide, unfortunately, that clearly isn't enough. I think the European experience shows that even with, they've got a price of about $40 a ton of CO2, and you still have countries like Italy and Germany and Czechoslovakia and the United Kingdom who are contemplating building new coal plants. I think people need to understand that kind of time has run out for dawdling on this. We need to have global emissions peak around 2015 to 2020 and then reverse course.
Help us understand the economic impact of that, though. This package before the Senate now is said that it would reduce carbon emissions in this country by about 70% from current levels by the middle of this century. And then the government would sell, like, permits for emissions that remained, and it would take trillions of dollars that came from that and invested in energy conservation, environmentally clean technologies, job creation, proponents say. Is that aggressive enough? Do you believe the steps contemplated before the Senate now would achieve a 70% reduction in U.S. carbon emissions by 2050?
Oh, I think this bill would do what it says it would do in the long term. I think people need to understand that this bill probably isn't strong enough to avert catastrophe, but what is very good about this bill is that it recognizes that if you want to keep costs to the economy low, you have to make major investments in low-carbon technology faster than the marketplace would do under left to its own devices. And one of the central things you must do is embrace aggressive energy efficiency. And of course, many states like Massachusetts and California have shown that if you just adjust utility regulations to let utilities make money on energy efficiency like they do from building new power plants, that you can achieve phenomenal savings. I mean, the work done by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and companies like McKinsey has shown that the energy and the National Academy of Sciences has shown that there are very large energy efficiency savings and that those savings can help pay for the cost of some of the more expensive strategies, which are some of the low-carbon power generation technologies.
Joseph Rumm, let me ask you, I put this to William Nordhaus, but again, here's Stephen Hayward. This is from the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal. So lots of people are reading this, saying that by the year 2050, Census Bureau projects that our population here will be about 420 million people. If you wanted a 70 or 80% reduction in carbon emissions, we'd have about per capita carbon emissions of about 2.5 tons. And he says that U.S. per capita emissions of carbon were never that low, even back in the colonial days. He says, you're going to have to be down in Haiti and Somalia terrain to make this work. And he asks, how on God's green earth will we make up the difference? How will we live with that? What do you say to that kind of analysis?
Well, it's kind of sad that the Wall Street Journal has such an editorial page that publishes such economic nonsense. It's called technology. Back 100 years ago, people didn't have advanced solar energy, advanced wind power, advanced energy efficiency technology, geothermal. The fact of the matter is that right now the fastest growing forms of energy are solar and wind. Now, it is certainly the case that you do need a price for carbon dioxide to help spur those technologies into the marketplace. But it is transparently clear that all of our electricity could be zero carbon electricity. It's just a matter of money. The notion that you have to become Somalia is absurd. The only question is solar, and by solar I mean not just photovoltaics, but concentrated solar power, wind, I'll even throw in nuclear. It's simply a matter of money to make electricity that doesn't generate CO2. It has nothing whatsoever to do going back to Somalia. Again, that's what I try to make clear, we're just talking money here. It is strictly a matter of money. And, one can't weigh the costs of action without asking what the cost of inaction is. And I just think people need to understand that the latest science says that inaction will have very dire consequences in terms of widespread drought and desertification, loss of the inland glaciers, which provide water to 1 billion people, sea level rise, loss perhaps of half the species, the oceans being rendered largely lifeless by ocean acidification. I mean, these are not the concerns of environmentalists. This is the peer-reviewed science signed off on by every single government in the world. So, we've passed the point where we should be listening to people who are trying to scare people into thinking that we have to become like Somalia.
Sounds catastrophic. To me, we've got a lot of listeners who want to join us. Joseph Rahm, William Nordhaus, please stand by. Emma in Fairfield, Iowa. Emma, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I would like to make a couple points.
Mm-hmm.
One is people are concerned about, horrible economics. If we look at countries that their goal is as close to zero point emissions and like 97-98%, towards zero point emissions, their goal is to do that. They have rearranged their economies to become green economies. They are more prosperous than they were before they went green.
You're talking about the EU primarily here.
People like William McDonough, who's written Cradle to Cradle and has worked with major corporations like Ford Motor Company and other companies. When companies turn 100% green, their profits increase rather than decrease. There is more prosperity in going green, and not just with carbon emissions. The thing with carbon emissions, it's important to look at what has been done in Europe and what has been successful and unsuccessful. On Amy Goodman's program, Democracy Now!, she has had people talking about what has actually happened in Europe with their carbon trades, and has found that it is not stringent enough, it buys still too much into corporate corruption, and that we are past the time of carbon emissions, that there needs to be far more stringent stuff, and connecting the dots between solar, wind, people putting photovoltaics on their own houses.
Yeah, Emma, we've got it. Let me put that to our guest right here, right now. William Nordhaus, you hear Emma's analysis, go 100% green and the economics of it pay for themselves. Let's do it. What do you say? This is common and enthusiastically embraced perspective among people who are pushing it. Do you agree with it?
Well, there's no doubt that there are some low-cost investments that could reduce CO2 emissions a lot. Whether they're actually going to pay for themselves or whether they're going to be low-cost, there's a big debate. I think there are probably going to be some modest costs of those. But the main thing, just to come back to a point Joe made that was very important, you've got some places here where you can have very, very deep cuts in emissions if you're willing to pay the price and the price is not too high. That is primarily coal-fired electricity. You've got almost 40% of our CO2 emissions coming out of that. And basically, I'd say if you want to look, if you're serious about this, that's the first place you look. You basically have to find a way to get us off of coal-fired electrical generation. That will solve about 40% of our problem. And we could discuss the best way to do that, but I think the best way to do that, you get your carbon price up to some level, whether it's $40 or $100, I don't know. And companies are going to find they don't want to generate from coal anymore. They want to go to other sources. But the people who run these generating plants, they're people with sharp pencils, and they're not going to do this unless they have strong economic incentives to do it, and it's not going to be free. Just one more thing on Europe. Europe has historically been a low energy intensity society. It's a little bit like New York, San Francisco. It's much more densely populated, mm-hmm. and much more fuel efficient structures and cars. In addition, France has a substantial amount of its electricity generated with nuclear power. So it started out before all of the climate change concerns arose as a very energy intensive, very energy inefficient area. The current program has not done a lot, but it has made a little tiny step down the road. One more point, if I might. Mm-hmm. I think the way to think of it is, I agree with the other guests that we have a long way to go, but I think, you know, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step, and the single step we need to do now is get the institutions in place, the measurement, the monitoring, the pricing, the trading mechanisms. Those are very, very big mechanisms. It's taken Europe 5 years to get those mechanisms in place. It's going to take us the same. And then at that point, we can look up, we can come up for air, and we can say, okay, do we need to tighten? Do we need to loosen? Do we need to change them? How are we going to interact with the rest of the world? But this first step, this is what the Senate is doing now, this first step is absolutely necessary.
But Joseph Rahm, Andrew Revkin, we heard from the New York Times, top of the show, says nil chance of this passing. He doesn't believe it's ever going to pass. He thinks that Americans are too politically averse to this kind of price or the fear of the economic price that may be in here for this to pass. So how do those institutions get up on the rails, those mechanisms that Bill Nordhaus wants to see?
Well, it's clear it's not going to pass this year. I disagree that it's never going to pass. I think it's very clear that Barack Obama and John McCain have both said that they intend to push for such a cap on emissions and trading system that will set a price for carbon dioxide. I agree that the politics is hard, and I think one has to be blunt. It is progressives and moderates in Washington and around the country that want to take action, and it's not just Democrats. I mean, we've got Governor Schwarzenegger in California who has committed to aggressive strategies, and so but there is the very diehard conservatives who represent a very powerful block in Congress, and they don't view this as a serious problem. Many of them don't accept that this is a problem at all. They just refuse to listen to what scientists say, and they're demagoguing this. They are saying, people are afraid of, you don't like gasoline prices now, imagine what it will be when we have a price for carbon. It's a very potent argument. I think it's a complete red herring, because I have no doubt that gasoline prices, which have been rising rapidly in the last few years, are going to be higher if we don't take action.
I mean, I saw somewhere in here they're in a panic because gas prices might go up by 50 cents over a period of several years.
25 years, yeah.
We've seen them going up by, sort of feels like a dollar at a whack in almost no time.
Well, and I think the key point is that the purpose of having the higher prices, as Dr. Nordhaus says, is to encourage efficiency and alternatives. So the point is that yes, the price of gasoline is going up one way or another. The issue is the federal government going to adopt policies that will push fuel efficient vehicles, that will push mass transit, that will and perhaps most importantly, get people to, I think, the car of the future, which is the plug-in hybrid electric vehicle, because driving on electricity is a lot cheaper than driving on gasoline, probably by a factor, it's probably the equivalent of about $1 a gallon. And again, making electricity carbon-free, pollution-free is considerably easier than making a liquid fuel that's pollution-free. So if you go to my blog, climateprogress.org, I spent a lot of time talking about what the solutions are that will get into the marketplace when we adopt the institutions and the trading system and government policies to encourage them. But if we, you know, if we listen to conservatives who just say we can't do this, America can't do this, it's impossible for us to do this, then we are going to face dire consequences. And I just don't understand why people buy into this can't do spirit. I completely agree with the woman who called in. America has been a technology leader for decades and decades. That's how we got that's how we got rich. And
let's go do it again. Well, we're wading into the waters here, and no doubt we'll be in deeper soon. You've both helped us learn a lot today, and I'm grateful for it. Joseph Rahm at the Center for American Progress, thank you. And William Nordhaus, author of A Question of Balance at Yale. Professor Nordhaus, thank you so much for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.